now in session. I have a couple of announcements on the agenda. We'll start first with House Bill 2315. That will not proceed to a work session today, but we will have a public hearing. House Bill 3124 is off pending further amendments. So I will open the public hearing on House Bill 2315 and ask counsel to explain the bill.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 23 makes several provisions, makes several changes regarding the Oregon Advocacy Center. The Oregon Advocacy Center was established in 1977, and its purpose is to protect and advocate for individuals with disabilities. You have before you -2 amendments that the purpose of those amendments is to delete several of the provisions that are currently in the bill. We'll go through the provisions and then talk about which provisions are deleted by the -2 amendments. And it's my understanding that there's another set of amendments on the way that will make some further deletions. And I think that the proponents or the people that will be testifying will talk about those further. One of the things that the bill does is expands the scope of individuals who are designated for protection and advocacy by the Oregon Advocacy Center. It's my understanding that the -2 amendments will delete that section. This bill also clarifies that the Oregon Advocacy Center may obtain records from covered individuals who are legal guardians of political subdivisions of the state. This bill will permit the Oregon Advocacy Center access to facilities and residents without being accompanied by staff of those facilities. That provision is going to be deleted by the -2 amendments. This bill requires that the facilities that deny access to the Oregon Advocacy Center provide a written explanation that sets out the reasons the facility denied access to the Oregon Advocacy Center. That division is not currently deleted by the -2 amendments, but I think the -2 amendments will either change that provision or delete it. And finally, the bill also replaces references to the Oregon Advocacy Center throughout the ORS just to make one consistent description.
Fine. Thank you, counsel. I have two people signed up for the bill, Kathleen Wild, and the second name, I get a Stan. I can't read the last name, so rather than being a terrible error, I'll let that person come forward also, and we'll decipher his last name at that time.
Good morning.
Testify in any order you wish. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathleen Wild. I'm the legal director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. I'm here to speak as the main proponent of the bill this morning. The council gave a good oversight of what our authorities are under federal law. They include protecting the rights of individuals with disabilities, and we've been given under federal law access rights both to records and to facilities in order to protect the rights of those vulnerable people. What this bill would do essentially is two things. The first is that it would make all references to the Oregon Advocacy Center consistent within the law. It's mentioned in 6 different places, differently in each. This would codify one single definition. The other thing it does is conform state law to federal law. Our authorities under state law were codified 15 years ago. Since that time, the federal government has expanded our authorities beyond people with developmental disabilities to also people with mental illness and people with physical impairments. Those federal statutes have the same authority for access to facilities and records as for people with developmental disabilities. These amendments will clarify that OAC has access authority that pertains to all individuals with disabilities, that pertains to the state as well as the political subdivision, and it pertains to individuals with disabilities in correction facilities. And finally, the facilities must give written notice if they deny access. While OAC has the authority under federal law to access these records and facilities. We have found it very helpful to have it in state law as well. Providers tend to look to state law to see what the authority is. They often draft their policies based on state law. It's much easier when you're trying to explain your authority if it's in state law, so that it's something that people are familiar with and are used to taking account of. Finally, over the last year, the Oregon Advocacy Center has worked very closely with the Oregon Youth Authority and with the Department of Corrections, and we have negotiated access agreements with both of those bodies. It's my understanding the Department of Corrections has some concerns about some of the provisions of our bill. We've been in conference with them, and those are amendments that we will not be objecting to. So we are fine with Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments, and it's my understanding that a Dash 3 amendment is going to be proposed. I'm happy to answer any questions.
We'll continue with the testimony, then ask questions to the panel. You may proceed.
Chair Ackerman and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Stan Zerniak, and I'm here to provide information on House Bill 2315. We in the Department of Corrections absolutely recognize the legitimacy and the value of the OAC to individuals who have mental disabilities and those who are in custody in the Department of Corrections. We recognize the rights of this group and that these rights are granted under federal law. And even though the OAC has been active in Oregon for about 15 years, our relationship with them is really relatively recent, I would say within about the last year or so. And so many of the issues of access to records and to our institutions are issues that we are working very closely with them to come up with a agreement as to how that will be done in procedure. Mr. Jundep has been a pleasure to work with. We've been able to openly express our concerns with this bill and with the access agreement that we are working on informally. And we've reached agreement on many of these amendments at this time. But there is language proposed on page 10. And it's line 10 and 11 that appears to include inmates with substance abuse issues in the OAC target population as persons with disabilities. About 70% of our inmates, that's about 9,000 inmates in the Department of Corrections, would benefit from some level of substance abuse treatment. At this point, we can't tell with any legal certainty the effect this language would have on Department of Corrections resources, and we're going to be introducing a Dash 3 amendment to strike line 10, and as indicated by counsel, we seem to have agreement with the OAC on this. We understand that Mr. Jundep may come up with other suggestions between today and the work session, and we are more than happy to work together on a mutually agreeable solution. Our interest is to have a good, positive relationship with the OAC for the benefit of our inmates and for the Department of Corrections. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Fine. Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? President Garrard, you're moving in that direction.
Yes. Kathleen, is this bill intended to reduce down to around that 70% figure?
I'm sorry, to reduce what 70% figure?
I haven't formulated the question in my mind yet, Mr. Chair, so I'll back off for the moment.
Okay. yes, Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, do you, on that line 10, on page 10, does that have anything to do with the court decision that came down about people that are addicts and stuff? That it is not a disease that came out just the other day?
Chair Ackerman and Representative Krieger, I really couldn't answer that. I don't think so.
Okay.
Further question for the committee? Representative Garrard, you're there now. Okay.
Yeah, I have my act together. Stan mentioned 70% of the 9,000 inmates might be affected or might benefit. Kathleen, how narrow of the population are you looking at this bill addressing?
When we, Chair Ackerman and Representative Girard, when we go into the prisons, our primary concern is people with mental illness receiving mental health treatment. We do not get into alcohol and drug treatment. That has not been our focus. What we're concerned about is whether people are receiving the necessary care, the necessary medications, and that is the focus of our work within the prison system.
Thank you very much.
Further questions? Seeing none, then thank you for your testimony. We'll await the amendments, and I will conclude the public hearing on House Bill 2315 at this time. Thank you. I'd like to recognize Representative Olson, who is one of our guest participants here. The representative serves on the criminal subcommittee, and occasionally we have people from the criminal subcommittee, such as he and Representative McPherson, sit with us to assist us with our caseload. So this is Representative Olson's first day on the civil subcommittee. I was in that capacity, and we welcome him.
Well, thank you.
I see Representative Butler here, so I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3352. And I'll have counsel explain the bill and the amendments.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 3352 provides that the surviving parent of a decedent does not inherit by intestacy if the decedent lacked capacity to make a will for at least 5 years before the death and the parent failed to provide support for the decedent for a period of 10 years or more before the decedent attained 18 years of age. Right now, if an individual does not have a will, that individual's property or estate passes through intestate succession. If that person does not have a spouse or children, then that property would pass to that person's parents. There's been situations where a person is disabled and has some amount of money and does not have contact with one of his or her parents. This bill is providing that in those situations that property would pass to the parent that the individual does have contact with, not the other one that may not be a part of that child's life. The -3 amendments also provide that if an individual dies before attaining the age of 18 years old and the parent failed to provide support for the decedent at any time during the life of the decedent, that parent would not inherit through intestate succession.
Thank you, counsel. Representative Butler, would you like to start?
Thank you very much, Chair Ackerman. I so appreciate the opportunity. My name is Tom Butler. I'm from House District 60. I've come here today on House Bill 3352. As your staff has indicated to you, this is a very narrow bill, but we were also told that any time that we talk about any modifications to the law of intestate succession, that it's like tipping over a box of mice. And so what we're concerned about is that we don't want to have any unintended consequences of shaking this box up before we tip it over, and we'd like to be able to contain the contents as much as we possibly can. And I do so appreciate the chair's astute knowledge and background in this regard as well, as we come to testify before your committee members. And in that regard, there have been attempts to make sure that we get this narrowed down. Chris Klein from the Oregon Bar Association, who deals specifically in these kinds of issues, has offered his discussions. And, Mr. Chair, you've had some ongoing discussion with Mr. Klein, and I do so appreciate that involvement. With that, we would proffer, and legislative counsel is here Dave Hendricks, who has helped us with the Dash 3 amendments to try and, again, keep the scope of it exactly where we should be.
Thank you. Mr. Hendricks?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Acting Legislative Counsel's Office. I did these amendments last night fairly quickly, on short notice, but the Dash 3s have two changes from what was in the original bill. And the first change was to make it clear that if you have one of these scenarios where the parent has not provided support and it is basically disinherited under the provisions of this will, it's not just the surviving parent who is disinherited, but even if the parent doesn't survive, that there would not be the property would pass to the children, to the heirs and devisees of that person. And that's on Dash 3 amendments at line 4, where you can see that it doesn't pass to the surviving parent of the decedent or to the heirs or devisees of a parent, not a surviving parent, of a parent, period. The second scenario that's found in lines 12 through 17 is essentially a situation where you have a parent who provides no support during the life of a minor who dies before reaching majority. And the one thing that I see this morning in looking at this language is on line 16 and 17, we had added these words at any time. And reading it this morning and hearing it called from counsel, I'm thinking that was not a good addition to this language. Because in reading it, I think you could read that sentence now to say the parent failed to provide support for the decedent at any time during the life of the decedent. That makes it sound like if you have a one-year period during which you didn't provide support, that you're disinherited, and that's not the intent. I would, at this point, suggest that we could strike those words at any time. We were trying to make it clear that it had to be failed to provide support for the decedent throughout the life or something like that, the life of the decedent. But in looking at that language this morning and hearing it again read back by counsel, I said, wait a minute, that can be read in a way that it wasn't intended.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this was brought by a constituent dealing with a very, very narrow situation with a child who was brain damaged at or near birth, subsequently abandoned by the father and not providing support, and then the child having accumulated a modest a home and some cash before death, leaving a mother who has worked full time in the home to support and sustain the child, will be disinherited by half of the home at the child's passing. And this was the concern that we were attempting to address. And I think with these modifications and potentially a Dash 4 amendment, and again, your indulgence and assistance, Mr. Chair, and that of Chris Klein from the Oregon Bar, I think that we will get this to the point where it is a piece of legislation which will address and identify. And then I've been given to understand that there are perhaps more of these kinds of situations that actually exist out there as a result of this. And so as we attempt to address this, we're trying to make certain that other folks who would like to, I hesitate to say pile on, but who have similar problems or may have similar problems with a disinherited or with a abandoned or abandoning parent would be able to utilize this to protect the caring parent that stayed behind.
Thank you. Other questions for the committee?
Yes, Representative Gerard. I think Representative Butler just went a long way to answering my question, but because I was curious as to how frequent are there situations that a, in essence, under this bill, a 13-year-old would have assets that a will would be necessary.
Mr. Chair, to Representative Gerard's question, while I do not practice at the bar, I have been given to understand that sometimes a child who may have been injured could have an award and that award could be a structured award, in such case providing for their lifetime necessities and maybe even providing for a home. In this case, the award was sufficient to provide for a modest home and enough to take care of the providing and caring parent. I've got a caring parent who has stayed in her home with her son now for the past 30 plus years, who will be disinherited, who will have to share the home and seek out the abandoning spouse or the abandoning parent, the abandoning father. We'll have to do a search to find the abandoning father and then provide that father half of the interest in the home. And basically, I've got a 50-plus-year-old grass widow that will have to return to the job market with no job skills having been acquired, no Social Security during her lifetime, having spent her entire lifetime caring 24/7 for this youngster. But I've been given to understand that it happens more frequently than just in this particular case.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Further questions from the committee?
Perhaps not a question, but in addressing that a little more fully, is that oftentimes in estate planning that would be called a special needs trust, as I understand it,
mm-hmm.
making provisions for the care and future care of persons with special needs.
Thank you, Representative. And I also, in pursuing some aspects of this bill, have come across situations where children do have substantial assets. The difficulty is because they are incapacitated or are too young to write a will, they can't pass the estate on to anyone. And unless this is closed, a deadbeat dad, for example, could inherit half the child's estate, maybe the entire estate in certain circumstances, and we're trying to plug that hole. The second tier of this was suppose the deadbeat dad, in this case, predeceased the child, the deadbeat's dad would inherit, the deadbeat's other heirs would inherit, and we're trying to cut off that inheritance line, and the bill, the dash 3, does that. Okay, further comments from the committee or from our participants this morning? Council has suggested that we eliminate the words at any time from lines 15 and 16 and 17 of the dash 3 amendment. Can we do that by conceptual amendment? And if so, I'd need some advice on what that process is. I'd like to move the bill today is what I'm trying to do rather than...
Technically, of course, we're not supposed to under the rules of the committee. I believe that's the rules
of the committee. Unless you have legislative council present, of course.
the other I'd actually change the sentence even a little more than that. I think I would make the sentence read, the parent provided no support for the decedent during the life of the decedent.
You're starting on line 16?
16. The parent provided no support for the decedent during the life of the decedent. I think that's a little clearer, and I think that's the intent, no support. It leaves open those tough proof problems of, you know, some minimal amount of support being provided by the parent. But the alternative is to start talking about minimal support or something and real proof problems and getting into that. The way it's written now, you have a burden of in this scenario where the decedent dies before reaching 18, you'll have to show basically abandonment. So,
yeah, my question is procedurally, can we amend the dash 3 and proceed into can we proceed into work session and amend the dash 3, or should we submit it back to Legislative Council? Chair Krieger.
Mr. Chair, you can move the bill as it is now, get the amendment, we can adopt it in full. Is that right, Mr. Sears?
All right.
That's one option, yes.
Yes, I think that's okay. We'll follow that procedure. We'll close the public hearing and move forward to the committee as a whole. And Council, will you take care of that amendment so that we can deal with it when the full committee meets? Thank you very much. Further testimony on House Bill 3352. Hearing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3352 and open a work session on House Bill 3352. We will need a motion for the dash 3 amendment. Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3352.
Representative Girard has moved the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 3352. Is there any objection, Council?
I thought we were going to move the amendments in the full committee. I believe there will be Dash 4 amendments, so I don't think it's necessary to move the Dash 3s at this time. I think we can move the bill to full committee and then adopt the Dash 4 amendments at that time.
That's correct.
Mr. Chair, withdraw my motion to add the Dash 3s to House Bill 3352.
All right, that's allowed. Then we'll need a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 3352 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
President Girard moves that House Bill 3352 be moved to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee? Hearing none, the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Warren?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth? Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 3352 is passed to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I'll close the work session on that, on House Bill 3352.
Carrier.
President Girard, please carry the bill, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2207. Please come forward.
Sure.
Council, please explain the bill.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2207 makes a technical fix regarding when agency is required to substantially comply with the rules regarding adopting rules. Right now, an agency is required to substantially comply with all the provisions. Those include several notice requirements, information that must be provided to the public, filing the rule with the Secretary of State 21 days prior to the adoption of the rule. They're required to substantially comply with those rules on the date the rule is adopted. House Bill 2207 changes that to provide that an administrative rule is not valid unless it is adopted in substantial compliance with statutory procedural requirements that are in effect on the date the notice of intent is to adopt the rule is delivered to the Secretary of State for the purposes of publication. That is at least 21 days before the rule is adopted, if not longer. What this bill does, if I understand correctly, is it syncs up the time in which an agency is going to substantially comply with these rules as opposed to having a time delay to when the rule is actually adopted.
Good morning. Mr.
Schradl. Yes. Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Philip Schradl, Special Counsel to the Attorney General. The department has proposed this bill primarily as a cost-saving mechanism and hopefully to avoid a bit of confusion, too. Council Sears has explained it quite clearly. What we're trying to do is move the date by which agencies, when they're promulgating administrative rules, need to comply with the notice requirements. Current statute calls for that to be, they have to have complied with the notice requirements that are in effect on the date that the rule is adopted. We're trying to move that forward in time to the time when the notice is actually filed with the Secretary of State. The reason for that is rulemaking proceedings can take a rather protracted long period of time, many, many months in some circumstances. And when changes are made to those notice requirements, any administrative rule proceedings that are in the pipeline at that point in time will need to be started all over again. That had the effect after the last 2003 legislative session that affected a number of administrative rule proceedings that were in effect. some people may be concerned that if a significant or substantial change to the notice requirements might occur during that time frame, that the legislature might in fact want to have those apply to any and all administrative rule proceedings that are kind of hanging out there in process. That could be accomplished at that time simply by having a notwithstanding clause language in that bill that would say notwithstanding ORS 183-335. The notice requirements imposed by this legislation apply to all administrative rule proceedings on rules that have not yet been adopted. So this changes that presumption, you know, if you will, and would, I think, avoid a substantial, or the opportunity at least, for a substantial amount of cost that could be incurred. Those rulemaking proceedings that the agencies were engaged in at the time of the last legislative session needed to be started all over again, which led to a delay in the adoption of the rules and additional costs. And I don't think that there was any significant purpose that was served by needing to go back over and start the administrative rule process all over again. So that's the goal behind the bill. And the effect of it would be, as I say, cost savings. I don't think there would be any adverse consequences at all. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Yes, Chair. Representative Olson.
Philip, a real simple question. How many instances did you have the past 2 years where this was a problem where actually you ended up having to start all over again?
Yeah. Chair Ackerman, Representative Olson, I can't give you the exact number because I actually am stepping in for somebody else from our office. I understand it was less than 10, but more, 5 to 10. I think it was in that neighborhood. And I can't give you an explicit dollar amount that was associated with it, but there was a time delay and cost associated.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I imagine some of those rule proceedings could be quite complicated. They could go anywhere from 2 or 3 paragraphs of the rule to maybe 2 or 3 chapters.
Chair Ackerman, that's correct. And, in fact, the more complicated and complex the rule proceeding is, the more length of time there is involved, and consequently the more opportunity for an occurrence like this to happen where they would need to start over.
All right. I don't see that this jeopardizes the rights of the public. Do you, Counsel?
Chair Ackerman, I don't either.
Okay, thank you. Are there further questions from the committee? Fine. Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2207? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2207 and open a work session on House Bill 2207. The Chair will move that House Bill 2207 be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Clerk will call a roll.
Representative Flores. Representative Garrard.
Aye.
Representative Worth.
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2207 is forwarded to the full committee. The due pass recommendation, and I will carry the bill. And the work session on House Bill 2207 is now concluded. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2359. Brad Swank, Dave Hendricks, and Gerald Watson, please come forward. Counsel, could you summarize this bill in less than 20 minutes?
I'll try to do that. Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2359 is a product of the Oregon Law Commission. As you probably are all aware, the Oregon Law Commission was created by this Legislative Assembly in 1997 to conduct a continuous program of law reform. This is one of the products of, as I said, the Oregon Law Commission. It is changing provisions to House Bill 2359, which was passed in 2003, which was a massive revision of the judgment statutes. And from that revision, other issues came up. And so this bill is addressing those changes. Some of them are merely technical, and I believe some of them are substantive. And I will leave it to the individuals before us to explain the specific provisions and sections.
Gentlemen, you may testify in any order you wish. Just state your name for the record.
Okay. Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Gerald Watson. I'm staff attorney with the Oregon Law Commission, here on behalf of the commission. And I just want to give you just a very brief background, let you know some of the materials that you've got, and then I will suggest that Dave Hendricks continue from that point. You have been provided with two pieces of information. You have a report from the judgment work groups of the Oregon Law Commission on this bill, which was approved by the commission itself. You also have a one-page statement from Gary Blackledge, who was a member of the work group, an active member of the work group, who was unable to be here today. His practice emphasizes debtor-creditor matters, and it's provided for your information and as written testimony. The work group that prepared the draft of this bill was very broadly representative of the interested parties. There were members of the debtor-creditor bar, representatives from the Department of Justice, the court system, title companies that would be very interested in judgments. It met frequently, as indicated in the report, and this is the work product that resulted from that considerable amount of effort on their part. I think that to the largest extent this is simply tweaking provisions of a bill that was a very large judgment bill that was introduced and passed in the 2003 session. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions, but if you have none in wanting to move this along quickly for you, I would turn it over to Mr. Hendricks.
You've been introduced, Mr. Hendricks. You're next.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Acting Legislative Counsel. Most of the bill is just tweaks, that things that were spotted after the bill was passed. The bill last session was the largest bill physically that was passed by the body, so it was unlikely that there wouldn't be a few things that needed to be looked at and adjusted, and that was the reason why the work group continued in existence during this last interim, to look at some of those issues. But there were a couple of larger things that came up, primarily because of the Court of Appeals looking at this new law and raising questions that were important to answer. Now, the Court of Appeals actually answered those questions that they raised, and they answered them the way that the work group agreed was the intent of the bill, but they felt it was still important to codify those results. And the most significant one probably is Section 2 of the bill, which addresses the question, having passed this large bill that created labeling requirements for judgments, that said you had to label them in certain ways and you had to do things differently than they had been done in the past, the question raised by the Court of Appeals is whether or not any of those requirements were jurisdictional for purposes of appeal. In other words, in one of the cases they asked, does the fact that one of the parties mislabeled one of the judgment document should have been general judgment and they labeled it as a limited, or in this case I guess it was vice versa, it should have been limited and it should have been general, is that jurisdictional? Can the Court of Appeals take that appeal, or did the legislature intend that those have to be sent back down to the court for further proceedings? And they decided that no, that wasn't a jurisdictional requirement. And the work group thought that was correct because of the consequences of not reaching that conclusion was the fact that liens created by that judgment might come in and out of existence, and that's the one thing that work group did not want to have happen with judgment liens. They wanted to have a very clear, bright rule about when liens came into existence for the purposes of title companies and people buying property. They needed to have that. So Section 2 basically says, look, the only things that are jurisdictional for the purposes of the appeal are 1, 2, and 3. They're very simple requirements, and so that should resolve problems of that nature, if there are any problems of that nature in the future. The other big issue that was discussed was from, and this was also a Court of Appeals case that came up, was what was meant when the bill from last section, 2646, indicated, defined a judgment to mean that a judgment was a concluding decision of a court on one or more claims. And the question raised by the Court of Appeal is, what is a claim for purposes of a judgment? Does this somehow change what is appropriate matters for being decided by a judgment? And we had very long and interesting discussions with Judge Landau from the Court of Appeals, who was before the House Committee earlier this session with a presentation. Also, Judge Linder from the Court of Appeals came over, and we have substantially rewritten the definitions to eliminate those concerns about what exactly it was that is appropriate to go into a judgment. That's a very sort of fundamental question. And frankly, I don't think it's a question that problem that was created by the bill. I think it one of the effects of these bills that rewrite huge areas of the law is that sometimes it highlights problems that are underlying and there all along and that hadn't really been considered until the legislature came in and put it in black and white and said, okay, courts, here's how we want you to do it. And they suddenly raised the question, well, what is an appropriate thing for a claim and how is that decided? And these changes to the definitional section in Section 4 addresses that and tries to make it clearer, gets rid of claim, use request for relief instead, defines request for relief to basically try to encompass those same things that everybody thought were appropriate for judgment as opposed to things that the court might do by order. Beyond that, a lot of technical changes. You have a report that I and Randy Jordan from the Department of Justice had written for the bill. If you have any questions about the report or the other changes to the bill, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Swank.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department. I worked with this work group. It's the third or fourth work group I've worked with for the Oregon. Anyway, for the commission, for the law commission. Sometimes it's too early in the morning for me. You'll have to excuse me. I know you have. Anyway, and this bill has a history. And the history, briefly, is that when the first 11 death penalty cases reached the Oregon Supreme Court in 1989, 10 of them got sent back to the trial courts because a judgment hadn't been entered. 10 out of 11. That was not just a problem with the courts, but sort of stood for the confusion of the law about what judgments were in 1989 at the time. Did a judgment require a writing? Did it have to be signed by a judge? Could it just be put on the record? Did it have to have all of the conditions of the sentence or of the money award, or what was required in a judgment? And we've been working in the Judicial Department on those issues for years. And the Law Commission took this up 5 years ago at this point to try and create a roadmap in statute to clarify and to resolve some of these issues. The big bill was passed last session, and last session it made a lot of clarification in the statute. You may remember Representative Max Williams, who was on the Law Commission at the time and sort of took this on as a personal project because he was not only concerned about the form of judgments and what had to be in the form of judgments, he was particularly concerned about the ability to collect on judgments because that's an area of law that he was very familiar with. And so he wanted to make sure that judgments had a certain effect and that people looking at them could tell what that effect was. And a lot of clarification was made in that area last session by the legislature, and judgments were more standardized. This bill, the follow-up bill, is a bill anytime, as Mr. Hendricks said, anytime that you've made a clarification in the law through statute, there are things that people are going to look at and go, oh, gee, I didn't expect that, or that wasn't clear. And so there's always a follow-up bill that comes through that sort of resolves issues that are created by ambiguities that people discover when the law is clearly written and set out in front of them. And that's what this bill does. There are a couple of things I would like to mention specifically. And yesterday when I was going through trying to figure out what I was going to say about this bill, I made available to Mr. Sears, your counsel, a copy of a memo I sent out to courts when this bill was first published, saying to the courts, this is what I think the bill does, these are problems the bill still has, and please comment to me, contact me if you've got further problems with the bill or you see further things that need to be done. So go, it does a section by section, explains problems. I can leave that. This is the same memo I emailed to Council Sears yesterday. And the problems that you'll note that the problems that it states in the back, and it's probably longer than you want to read right now, but if you've got questions about it later, feel free to call me. For whoever has to carry it on the floor, this really does sort of an issue-by-issue analysis of what goes on. The issues that I mentioned in the back of things that still need to be addressed are things that are, in fact, addressed in the Dash 1 amendments that the work group worked on after that. There is one other thing that I want to mention in relation to this bill. It's a cleanup bill. If you look at section at page 5 of the judgment work group report from the commission itself, in the first full paragraph, the one starting section 3 on that, I believe that paragraph is one that at the last commission meeting was supposed to be modified. I attended the meeting, and actually section 3 of the bill is not intended to authorize the Chief Justice. It's intended to clarify the authority that some of us believe that the Chief Justice already had, and that was reflected in the previous bill, and that was in fact used after last session's bill, and to in fact in some instances narrow that authority. And the question that comes up is, does the Chief Justice have the authority by order or rule to authorize the use of limited or supplemental judgments? And we thought that question was resolved after last session's bill. In fact, we used that authority during the interim to authorize the use of limited judgments for the application contribution program for indigent defense. And that's where an attorney is appointed and the person is supposed to pay part of the fees, and the court uses a limited judgment at that time, at the beginning of the case, to require the person to pay those fees for part of the contribution for the indigent defense attorney. That way they can collect on those fees during the case. And that money, of course, goes back to the general fund, and that's one way that authority was used during the last interim. So that's a clarification. There was another concern, and that concern was that the as otherwise provided by law, which was the phrase that was previously used, would allow local courts, by local court rule, to establish circumstances when limited or supplemental judgments could be used. And the decision of the work group was that it might be appropriate to use to standardize that at statewide through the Chief Justice, but to have each local court deciding whether they're going to have an interlocutory appeal on a case by using a limited judgment was probably not where we wanted to go. So if you look at the bill on page 2, lines 23 through 27, the way the bill addresses this is to define legal authority, and basically in the definition of supplemental or limited judgments, and I should explain, limited judgments are judgments that are entered before a general judgment. Supplemental judgments are judgments that are entered after general judgment, and the general judgment is supposed to be the judgment that ties up the entire case. So you've got small judgments that deal with less than the whole case and don't stop the case, and then you got the one big judgment, which is the general judgment that's supposed to tie up the case. And the theory is still that in most cases we want just one judgment, a general judgment, but in some cases it's appropriate to resolve some issue early or some issue late. Anyway, the legal authority that's used is statute, Oregon Rule of Civil Procedure, Rule of the Order of the Chief Justice adopted under Section 3 of this Act, or all controlling appellate court decisions in effect on December 31st. So it was pre-existing law in the authority of the Chief Justice. So that clarification, that particular section, Section 3, is a clarification of the Chief Justice authority, not new authority being granted. Other than that, the bill does a lot of cleanup. The Dash 1 amendments are the product of the work group to clean up further issues that were brought forward to it after the bill was published, and we continue to look for things to make this better and to make the process work better. So what happened in 1989, the confusion about what the law of judgments is, doesn't continue, and it becomes clearer what a judgment does. I can answer any questions the committee wants.
Thank you. I appreciate all the work you've done to bring us these materials to us. I remember the bill from last session, and it was huge, and nobody wanted to touch it. And I've kind of seen this mostly as a picking up on some of the points that were not fully developed in the earlier bill. I do want to ask a question. Are there any substantive changes in the law in this bill?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks again. That line between substantive and non-substantive, I think that the two changes that I talked about with respect to the Court of Appeals decisions merely codify those decisions. Section 9 of the bill arguably is a substantive provision in that, although I'm not sure, but that child support administrator at DOJ has been doing it anyway. It basically allows for liens to come in and out of existence, to basically release a lien and then reinstate it. I believe they may have been doing that anyway, but they wanted to have it clear in these statutes that that could happen. And the report gives you examples of the types of situations where that might occur. Primarily, it has to do with situations where, for instance, the person receiving the support has real concern about threat to the safety of that person, wants nothing further to do with the person paying the support, and says, I want them to go away, I want the lien to go away, I don't want to have anything to do with them. And then at a later date, it's reinstated for one reason or another, and they want the lien to come back into existence. So I'm not sure if that is something they had been doing and this just recognized it, or if this really is new authority to do it.
I understand that liens can be released, you know, by the judgment creditor, and it usually isn't it done by motion and order, and then also be reinstated in the same way. This seems like it's sort of self-executing by the administrator, and I don't know how the administrator knows to do that.
Yeah. The general rule is you can't reinstate judgment liens once you release them. That was part of the problem that the Child Support Division saw, that if you go in on a judgment lien and file a release, at that point, generally, that's it. You cannot come back in later and say, I've changed my mind, if you're the judgment creditor, and reinstate it. But there are special circumstances. In fact, I believe there may even be federal law involved with respect to this, where in child support matters, there's a need to be able to reinstate a lien that previously had been released. And so this provides clear authority for doing that.
Okay, thank you.
The other thing I would point out is, on page 11 of the bill, we amend ORS 18165. That was a very contentious statute that was discussed at length as part of the original bill, and the work group was unable to reach consensus on. And it's a technical question. It has to do with the priority between the judgment lien and a person who has taken a conveyance of that property but not recorded it. So the scenario is the judgment creditor goes out, they get their judgment, and a lien attaches, but there's another person out there who has previously bought the property but not recorded the interest in the property. In the old law, if you just read the statute, and it's at lines 14 through 16, if you read it, it basically seems to suggest that those interests of the person with the contract are basically void. And if you just read that, if that's all you read, you would say, well, that's what happens. They lose because they didn't record, which is what they should have done. But the courts had interpreted this statute in a very funny manner, and the cases are cited in the report, to basically turn this around and say that, in essence, the person who held that unrecorded interest would beat the judgment lien. You have to read the case to see how they got there. They're older cases, but they were very clear on that point. And the concern was is that this statute purportedly said one thing on its face when you read it, but it had been interpreted by the courts differently. The work group went through and came up with a fairly extensive rewrite on this and essentially said, took a middle position on most of these, essentially saying that the person who had the unrecorded interest loses unless they get it recorded within 20 days after they receive it. So it's only it puts a duty on the person who takes one of these interests in this property to get in and record it and not just sit on an unrecorded instrument. Anybody going through the title company is not going to have a problem, because if you go through the title company, they do that all at exactly the same time. Stuff is recorded, etc. So usually you're not going to have an issue. But if the principle here is that if you take a piece of property, you've got a title report showing there's no judgments against it, you better get in and record it, because otherwise you may lose out to a judgment that comes along at some later time, because you just haven't put the world on notice that you have this interest. So this is a change in the existing law, in that there was a lot of discussion about how they wanted to change it and what kind of rule they wanted to come up with.
Thank you. Representative Olson, do you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess it's more just kind of directed towards you, or it could be for the panel. Just quick review of this. It just appears that this bill provides more flexibility as it applies specifically toward judgments, that descriptions of those types of judgments, and then also the liens.
Comments?
Chair Ackerman, Representative, I think what it does is it clarifies a lot of the gray area that was happening. It draws clearer lines in some instances. There are some places where it does provide a little more latitude. For instance, in the area of orders, it makes it clear that some cases can be decided by orders. Now, most, for instance, an order to dismiss or a stalking order decides some cases, and it was not clear in previous law whether every case had to be decided by a judgment. And the theory was that if you decide by a judgment, you get certain things. Certain, you know that you get appealability. You know that if there's a money award, you get a lien. You know there's certain other things you know. You know that there's certain kinds of issue preclusion. But some, you don't always know what you get with an order, but some people still resolve cases by orders, and that in some instances is still allowed. This doesn't preclude it. So it clarifies the gray area, and I expect that you will be, it's an area that I've actually been working on for around 17 years in terms of trying to clarify what judgments do and what effects they have in courts, and I expect that this session will not be the last you hear about the nature of judgments.
I think because of the scope of the earlier the bill 2 years ago, it was just designed to have a built-in learning curve, and a lot of the practitioners didn't get up to speed quick enough. Judgments were still mislabeled. The courts were still trying to figure out what they were for appeal purposes or for the entry of a valid lien. This goes a long way, I think, in straightening some of those problems out. I think we still have the learning curve with us, though. Further questions from the committee? I had maybe just a couple. On page one of the bill, at line 15, where it reads, the court administrator for the circuit court rendering the judgment must note in the register that the judgment document has been filed. Sometimes there is a difference between the date the judgment is signed by the judge and the date that it's entered in the register of the court, which is applicable for appeal procedures in counting the 30-day notice of appeal requirement.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, it's the date that it is shown as being entered in the register that starts the appeal clock ticking, not the date that it's signed by the judge. Because that's the date that has been filed with the clerk. It's publicly available, and the register acts as sort of notice to the world. And as you're probably aware, we have a number of attorneys who have OGIN online, so they can look up on their own computer when it's been entered in the register. Otherwise, they'd have to chase down to the courthouse and say, "Has the judge signed that yet? Has the judge signed?" And so it establishes a firmer, clearer date that people can easily check.
Okay, fine. Thank
Chair Ackerman, the other thing I'd add to that is that the bill last session actually went out of its way to create a clear definition of what it meant to enter. And that was very helpful, I think, because before there was a lot of debate about what it meant to enter it in the register, and made it clear that it's the notation in the register that the judgment had been filed with the clerk. And so one of the things the bill did was try to address that as far as when exactly that magic date was.
Okay, I had just another question on page 3, line section 7, which applies sections 2 to 6 of the bill to all judgments entered on or before January 1, 2004. What's the purpose of that retroactive effective date?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, most of what's going on 2 to 6, is, as I mentioned before, was to conform the law to what the Court of Appeals had said it meant. And so the purpose of that section is to make it clear that these changes don't just apply to judgments entered on or after the effective date of this act, which will be January 1st, 2006, but goes back to the changes made by House Bill 2646, and that this is meant to be a clarification of the law, not a change in the law. So it made sense to make it apply retroactively to the effective date of 2646.
I understand. Thank you. Further questions then from the committee? I do not anticipate any amendments to this bill, so we're through at this point.
You have the dash ones.
I have. Yes, I think I do. I have dash ones. Will there be any others?
I don't know about the others. Chair Ackerman, my understanding is that the Law Commission left it open if other people brought forth problems that were actually generated by the bill, that they would leave it open to consider amendments on the Senate side. So far, none have come forward to me that can't be addressed. But if there are technical issues that pop up with the bill that somebody hasn't noticed before, we might want to address them on the Senate side. But as far as I know, all of the issues, at least that have been raised to me, or that have been raised in the work group, have been addressed in the dash one amendments.
Fine, I appreciate that. I want to bring this to a conclusion by a general judgment rather than a limited judgment this afternoon.
Very good.
All right, further testimony on House Bill 2359. Hearing none, I'll conclude the public hearing on House Bill 2359 and open a work session on House Bill 2359, and I'll need a motion on the dash one amendments, please.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2359.
Thank you. Representative Flores moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2359 be incorporated within the main bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection? That's allowed. Motion on the main bill is amended. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2359 to the full committee as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves that House Bill 2359, as amended, be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee. Hearing none, Clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2359, as amended, is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Representative Flores, you wish to carry the bill? That's a yes. Thank you very much. And with that, I'll conclude the work session of the House Bill of 2359. Thank you. All right, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2524. We have two participants, John Miller, John Langenham. You want to come forward, each of you, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Sean Miller here today on behalf of the Oregon Rental Housing Association in support of House Bill 2524 on the Dash 2 Amendment. At the last hearing, we discussed the process that we go through as a landlord-tenant coalition group in the interim to negotiate this particular bill. Normally, Mr. Chairman, it would not be me up here testifying today. It would be Sharon Fleming Barrett, who I just want to say passed away a few weeks ago with cancer. And I know it's been difficult for all of us. She's been a good friend of not only myself, the coalition, and about every landlord in the state knows Sharon. But I do want to acknowledge to the committee the significant contribution that she's had on this process over the decades. She's been negotiating this bill and working with John, who is the principal drafter of this bill. And on behalf of my organization and the coalition and Sharon, we would urge her support.
I could just interrupt you for a moment. I forgot to have counsel explain the bill, so we're not quite there yet. Appreciate your comments. Let me interrupt and have counsel explain the bill, and then we'll come to the public testimony. Counsel?
Chair Ackerman, member of the committee, House Bill 2524 is a bill brought before you by the Landlord-Tenant Coalition, as Mr. Miller has mentioned. That coalition consists of 13 landlords and tenants, and they work together to compromise, and they have done so in this bill regarding several issues, which I will let Mr. Van Landingham and Mr. Miller explain. You have before you dash two amendments that that are the substance of the bill and have all the I think necessary changes that are needed.
Gentlemen,
Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it over to John to explain the elements of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John Van Landingham, Lane County Law and Advocacy Center. I'm a legal aid lawyer in Eugene. Since 1993, I've been the principal tenant negotiator within the coalition and the principal drafter for the coalition and the principal explainer, the person who comes before you and explains what the coalition is trying to do. The Residential Landlord-Tenant Act was passed by the legislature in 1973. Since then, no amendments have occurred to the act without coming through a coalition of both landlords and tenants. And that requires the two sides to get together and figure out what's important and what's agreeable. Sean mentioned Sharon Foreman Barrett. I met her in 1989. So she was a primary landlord negotiator for all those years, somebody that we all came to trust and rely on. We appeared before you about 3 weeks ago, Sean and I. At that time, you had just received the Dash 1 amendments. Most of the bill is in the Dash amendments. You had just gotten them and weren't ready to move. I wanted to make some additional changes. They're in the Dash 2. The Dash 2 amendments do what the coalition wants you all to do, if you would. While they're lengthy, there are really only seven substantive issues in them. Most of the sections are corrections or either reorganizations of existing statutes or cross-reference corrections. Unlike previous sessions, we're not making significant or recommending significant changes to the Landlord-Tenant Act. That partly reflects some new members within the coalition and some complex issues that took us a long time to resolve. I could summarize those seven significant issues if you wish. However, they may be only of interest to landlords and tenants, and so I would defer to you, or I can answer questions, whichever you would like.
Thank you, gentlemen. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would appreciate a seven bullet point highlight of the Dash 2 amendments.
Gladly, Representative Flores. The first issue has to do with garnishment of deposits. Landlords typically require tenants to pay a security deposit. The money is held by the landlord. The landlord gets to use the money. But at the end of the tenancy, the landlord is responsible for accounting to the tenant for the deposit. If the deposit is gone during the tenancy, the landlord is probably going to require another one. Some creditors have discovered the concept of garnishing the deposit from the landlord. That approach was litigated in Oregon and appealed from Oregon to, it was in federal bankruptcy court in Portland, appealed to the Ninth Circuit in San Francisco, and the Ninth Circuit agreed, all three court levels have agreed that security deposits are exempt under Oregon's homestead exemption laws, which are about $30,000. So courts have ruled that security deposits are exempt from garnishment. The first issue is to make that clear in the Landlord-Tenant Act, because we view the Landlord-Tenant Act as a guideline for landlords and tenants. Most landlords are not lawyers and do not hire lawyers, and nor do we want to make them have to hire lawyers. So we want them to be able to use the Landlord-Tenant Act without consulting and paying a lawyer, and this will help them understand what that issue is. The second issue has to do with evictions of tenants by landlords. There are a number of ways that landlords can evict tenants. One of them is something we refer to as a 30-day for-cause notice, in which the tenant does something, breaks the rental agreement, breaks the statute, and the landlord gives the tenant a 30-day notice saying, in essence, dear tenant, you've done X wrong. It has to say what the tenant has done wrong, and you've got 14 days to fix that, or else your tenancy terminates in 30 days. some tenants have viewed that with regard to certain conduct as essentially saying to the tenant that you can keep doing that for that 14-day cure period. And the most concerning example, and I live in a college town, would be that you can keep having a loud party every night for the next 13 days after getting that notice. Well, that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to give the tenant a reasonable period of time to fix the problem. So we're amending the statute to say that if the cause of the notice is a discrete act, such as a party, the tenant must cure that cause by stopping it once the tenant gets the notice. It's a big issue to landlords, hard to write, hard to make it work in statute, but we think we've done that. The third issue, third and fourth issues really have to do with applicants and the situation in which a tenant apply or an applicant applies for a new tenancy. Sometimes they're turned down. Federal law requires in many cases that if a landlord's using a credit report, federal law regulates credit reports, that the landlord has to give a written reason for the denial, and we're simply adding that to state statute to make it so that the landlord would have to give the tenant, or the, excuse me, the applicant, a form or notice saying, I've turned you down because of bad credit or a bad reference or insufficient income, something like that. The fourth issue has to do with an applicant who has a prior eviction. We refer to it as FEDs, forcible entry and detainer. It's an old English common law term. So if an applicant has had a prior FED on his or her record, the law is unclear, and we're trying to clear it up to make it so that if the tenant didn't lose that prior, that applicant didn't lose that prior FED, the landlord can't deny them just because of that prior FED. If the applicant lost that prior FED, absolutely, the landlord, and we're making that clearer, that the landlord can deny the applicant because the tenant lost that prior FED.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
When you say lost the FED, that means in a challenge to the validity of that having been entered, an FED?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores is correct.
Gotcha.
We've actually had to resort to the judgment statute from the last session and the work that they're doing this session to try to understand judgments as well. So we've paid attention to that. The fifth issue has to do with meth labs and abandoned property. Abandoned property, the term sounds as if the tenant has walked away, but in some cases the tenant has been removed from the apartment or the mobile home space that they rented and hasn't yet been able to remove the personal property that was left there, and that's still treated as, quote, abandoned property. And the statute, current statute very carefully regulates how a landlord treats that abandoned property so that the landlord gives the tenant notice, gives them a set period of time in which they have to claim the abandoned property. If they don't, the landlord's authorized to sell it or throw it away. That doesn't work if the apartment has been determined to be unfit for occupancy or unfit because of the presence of a meth lab. Now, the meth lab may be there not due to the fault of the tenant. It could be the neighboring apartment where the meth lab was, and yet the area that's considered to be contaminated is broader than the meth lab apartment. But basically, the authorities post that apartment, and nobody's supposed to enter it except for the authorized cleanup people, including the landlord. So the landlord can't take control of the abandoned property, and it's not fair to say that the landlord's got a certain amount of time to return that abandoned property because the landlord has no control over the property while it's being considered a meth lab. So we've amended the abandoned property statute to make it clear that during that period, until the cleanup people have determined that either the apartment or the abandoned property is clean, the abandoned property statute doesn't apply. The sixth issue has to do with stipulated agreements and also involved the new judgment statute. In the situation where an eviction is filed as a lawsuit, an FED is filed, the courts typically, and this is especially true in Portland, Multnomah County, which has more evictions than anybody else, the courts encourage the parties to settle. Sharon Fleming Barrett was considered to be a master at working out those agreements. And, in fact, there was a part of the hallway outside the courtroom that was referred to as Sharon's office. We've over the years written the statute so that to encourage that. and that the parties enter a stipulated agreement. It could be that if the eviction is for non-payment of rent, that the tenant gets to stay in the apartment if the tenant makes certain payments by certain dates. And to encourage that, we have written it so, you have approved it so, that if the tenant doesn't keep that stipulated agreement, the landlord can convert that to a judgment without filing, without having to file a new eviction lawsuit, without having to pay new fee, filing fees and wait another 2 weeks to get into court. The landlord can do that by filing an order with the court saying that the tenant did not comply with the agreement. And then the clerk will convert that to a judgment. The landlord can enforce the judgment by taking it to the sheriff. It's a fairly speedy process at that point. We also, though, have built in so that a tenant can object and say, that's not true. I did comply. Because in some cases, the landlord may be wrong. The tenant did comply with the agreement. Sharon Fleming Barrett, in particular, was concerned that there were some tenants in Portland and Multnomah who were abusing that and asking for hearings. Asking for hearings on whether they had complied. And what this bill will now do is allow Multnomah County or another county that sets up an ex parte process. Ex parte means that you can appear before a judge who can review the contents of your piece of paper, your affidavit, on the face of it to see whether it meets the statutory requirements. A lot of tenants were asking for hearings, checking or filling out information that indicated they had no basis to delay the FPD. But there was no way for anyone to challenge that without actually having the hearing. That meant more delay. So we're trying to expedite the process for landlords and reduce the number of frivolous hearings. The last issue has to do with amending a current form to take out some archaic language.
Thank you
probably
very
more
much.
Than you needed
very,
to know.
It's very explanatory. I've had a request from Brad Swank to come forward and testify. Would you like to come forward now, Mr. Swank, and then we'll continue with the questions after your testimony.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the Oregon Judicial Department. I actually just had a chance to look at these amendments as they were put out on the table this morning, and I've been going through them because they are extensive, 70-some pages. And normally, landlord-tenant law changes insofar as they just change the procedures for court in minor ways. Aren't something that the courts worry about as long as we can afford to do the procedures. In this instance, in looking through this bill, I did find a provision on page 71 of the dash 2 amendments, lines 1 through 4. It says the talking about ex parte review in front of a court. It says the ex parte review must be available every judicial day for appearance by the defendant before court within the time period between the service of the notice of restitution and the date of expiration of the notice of restitution. That means at some point every court in this state all day should have somebody available to do ex parte hearings for landlord-tenant issues. Some courts, for instance, Multnomah, where we have a number of judges, that might be easier than some courts, for instance, in Baker City, where we have one judge, or in some courts in the 7th Judicial District, where we have five counties, and the three judges actually ride circuit, so they're not in every court every day. And the time they spend in court can be precious. This appears to me, I just thought I would bring it to your attention, to potentially be a cost issue for courts and of some concern. I haven't had a chance to look at it in terms of making a judge available every day for landlord-tenant. The other issue is one of the things that I heard mentioned was they said that this bill had been some of the changes were with respect to the use of the judgment, the changes that were made by the judgment bill. And on page 47, line 16, and I saw it one other place, but I couldn't chase it down again, it uses the term final judgment. And one of the things that the judgment bill did was eliminate the term final judgment because there is some question about whether a judgment is ever final because it can always get modified later, those sorts of things, and it was a term that had confused the work group in terms of the judgment bill. The judgment bill uses the term general judgment, generally, or a limited judgment or supplemental judgment. So I didn't have a chance to check other places, but I thought I would raise those two issues for the committee in terms of the dash two amendments, and I'm more than happy to check out the language about the availability of judicial positions with our courts to see if there would be costs involved with that, or to talk to the interested parties and see what we could do about it. And I can answer any questions. But I've just had a brief review of these amendments.
Okay, I want Mr. Van Landingham to respond to your points, and we'll carry it from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. John Van Landingham again. As I said, I've been doing this since 1991, and I've learned the hard way not to fail to anticipate concerns by the court administrator. We worked very closely with the court administrator from Multnomah County, and have for years, to make sure that whatever we do has minimal impact on the court, the cost of the court system. And he has reviewed all of these changes and signed off on them. And in fact, Sharon Fleming Merritt, one of her tasks was to be that contact, and she worked very closely with him. That's one answer. The second answer is that this is an optional process. This is not the concern that Mr. Schwenk is raising with regard to an ex parte process is optional for a court. It says to a county court, if you wish to review, have a judge review the merits of these tenant requests for hearings, you don't have to. But if you want to do that, then what you have to do is set up an ex parte process. This is modeled exactly on what Multnomah County does. So we are simply saying, Multnomah County, this is, if you want, they're doing it without any authority right now, frankly. So I believe that this would confirm what Multnomah County is doing, and simply saying, we like what Multnomah County is doing, we're willing to try that and see if that will reduce the number of frivolous hearings. Multnomah County Court has signed off on it.
Chair Ackerman.
I think, Counsel, you're referring to the fact that the language of incorporating the ex parte process is prefaced by the word may rather than shall.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Any right. County may choose to do this as a effort to reduce the number of hearings that the counties want to do. If they don't want to do this, they do not have to do this. They do not have to provide this ex parte system.
And is it your court experience at this time, sir, that most courts do have ex parte proceedings every day at a scheduled time?
Representative Chair Ackerman, you and I both practice in the same court, and that court does. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2524? Again, thanks to the coalition to bringing a good package to us without a lot of controversy, but also with a lot of work. The committee appreciates that. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2524. We open the work session on House Bill 2524 and entertain a motion on the dash two amendments. Representative Garrard.
Mr. Chair, I would move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2524.
Representative Garrard moves that the dash two amendments be incorporated within the main bill of House Bill 2524. Are any objections? Any discussion? Hearing none. That's allowed. Motion on the bill.
Representative Chair. Garrard. I would move House Bill 2524 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Garrard moves House Bill 2524 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion from the committee? Hearing none, the clerk may call a roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
Aye.
Representative Wirth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. House Bill 2524 as amended is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I will now close the work session on House Bill 2524.
Who'll be the carrier on that?
And Representative Garrard will be the carrier of that bill. I think that exhausts our agenda for this morning. Any further business before the committee?
I'm sorry. Would I be able to request a statement in order to register my vote on two bills?
Did you miss the vote too?
Which one?
I don't.
23. Representative Worth, did you miss any votes?
I think 23-15.
Yeah.
Representative Flores missed 22-07.
And 23-15.
And 23-15.
And 23-15.
And Worth has 23-15.
15.
15? Yeah, okay.
Well, who voted on 23-15?
Did you?
There was.
Those were the two that passed.
Oh, well, we didn't move 23-15 out.
We took that and didn't go forward. So we're just dealing with your two votes.
Okay, no, we didn't.
Yeah, we didn't move that one.
No, it was a public hearing only.
Yeah. So just 22-07. We didn't move that one.
Representative Worth, did you vote on 22-07?
Yes.
Yes,
so you're okay now. All
thank
right.
Thank
you. Chair will move to suspend the rules to allow Representative Worth to vote on House Bill 22-07. Is there any objections?
Representative Flores.
Excuse me?
Representative Flores, not Worth.
I'm sorry.
We're close to the same age, but I understand it.
Yeah, I got you. Okay, I'll start again. The chair will move to suspend the rules to allow Representative Flores to vote on House Bill 2207. Is there any objection? Hearing none, that's how the rules are suspended. Representative Flores, how do you vote on House Bill 2207?
Aye.
Representative Flores votes aye. Further business before the committee this morning? Hearing none, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Getting through this quickly.